This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. On the program today, jobs, Bitcoin, and yes, fine, that debt limit thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today. This one is the 31st of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. While there are still votes left to cast and miles to go before we don't have to talk about the debt limit anymore or don't have to talk about it for at least a couple of years, it is nonetheless true that the deal the White House made with House Republicans to neutralize the GOP's threat to force the United States into default, it is a multi-trillion dollar intervention in the American economy. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says that if it does become law, again, still votes to count, it would reduce government spending by roughly $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. And that sounds like a lot of money. But is it? Really? Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
Government spending certainly can influence the economy in a big way. Laura Veldkamp, an economics professor at Columbia, says look at what happened after the government increased spending during the pandemic and gave people relief checks. People went out and spent them.
That is an increase in demand. Demand is when we go and buy things. And so this gave people money to do exactly that.
And on the flip side, Veldkamp says a reduction in government spending can reduce demand in the broader economy, which is what the Federal Reserve is trying to do by raising interest rates. Veldkamp says government spending cuts could make the Fed's job easier.
If there's less demand for things, if there's fewer purchases, investments by business, that's going to put less upward pressure on prices.
Thing is, there is a lot of government spending that the debt ceiling deal does not cut. It focuses on capping discretionary spending, money the government uses to fund different agencies and programs. Thing is,
discretionary spending is one-third of all government spending, and half of that is military spending, which Republicans didn't want to touch.
That's Justin Wolfers, an economics professor at the University of Michigan. This week, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs estimated that the deal would shave off just about a tenth to two-tenths of a percentage point from overall GDP.
It does slow the economy, but not in a particularly meaningful way.
To be clear, Wolfers says that's not a bad thing. Josh Bivens, chief economist at the Economic Policy Institute, says the economy might not need to slow down.
I think the unemployment rate we have today, I don't think it's too low. I don't think it's causing undue inflationary pressure. I think it's mostly causing pretty good wage growth.
On the other hand, the deal's expanded work requirements for certain benefits could cause fewer people to receive them. Menzie Chen is an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin.
Essentially, you're putting on additional administrative burdens for people to receive these benefits.
And that part of the deal would have an outsized impact on more vulnerable parts of the economy. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Two quick macroeconomic addenda before we move on here. First of all, we got the poetically named JOLT today, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. A couple of quick nuggets from it. Number one, the number of job openings in this economy went up in April for the first time in 4 months. However, comma, and number two, the number of people leaving their jobs on the theory that they could get better ones held steady. So we'll call that mixed overall and let the Federal Reserve sort it out. Speaking of which, the Fed, that is, and this is item number two. A very interesting comment from Philip Jefferson today. He has been nominated to be the vice chair at the central bank. Jefferson said, and here I quote, skipping a rate hike at a coming meeting would allow the committee to see more data before making decisions. The Fed, as we know, because Jay Powell tells us all the time, is all about the data. Next meeting, should it not be on your calendar already, is June the 13th and 14th. Wall Street on this Wednesday, traders were a little glum, TBH. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back when inflation really started to take hold in this economy, which I know feels like a long time ago, but really was only in 2021, we spent some time on the show talking about something called a wage price spiral, that rising wages would oblige businesses to increase prices, which would lead to more wage increases and so on and so forth. Well, belay my last, because there is a new paper out from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco that shows that that didn't happen. Rising wages, the paper says, are only responsible for about a tenth of a percentage point of the increase in the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, personal consumption expenditures, which is to say, really wasn't much of an effect at all. We had Marketplace's Lily Jamali look into the why of the whole thing.
The PCE index measures inflation in three categories: goods, housing services, think rent, and, says Adam Shapiro of the San Francisco Fed, the very broad non-housing services.
Hotels, restaurants, and then smaller categories such as airlines, public transportation, haircuts, and things like that.
And that's where most of the inflation has been happening lately. Labor makes up a huge portion of costs in that category, but Shapiro found,
when a business's cost structure changes, so if their labor costs increase, they don't necessarily have to pass on those costs to consumers.
And so as wages at the low end of the spectrum have risen, some companies have swallowed those higher labor costs by reducing their own profits. Others have changed their offerings. Nancy Bame is co-owner of Pint Size Bakery and Coffee in St. Louis.
For example, we don't make decorated cookies anymore. They take a ton of time. You can't really charge what they're worth.
Bame's been paying more lately for packaging, like coffee cups, and ingredients, too. Same goes for labor. She's paying about 25% more to four bakers, three full-time baristas, and one part-timer. But she's only raised her prices by around 10%. That may be about the most she can get away with, says Brad Hirschbein of the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research.
If you're a local bakery and there's another bakery, down the road, you're in more trouble if you try to raise prices.
But if you're a well-known brand with a lot of loyalty, Hirschbein says you might be able to raise prices a lot more. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
The world's biggest Bitcoin convention happened a couple of weeks ago in Miami Beach. For just $999, that's fiat currency, about 0.00037 Bitcoin, you had the chance to spend a couple of days with 12,000 or so of your fellow Bitcoin enthusiasts doing all manner of Bitcoin things. Peruse the Bitcoin art gallery, for instance, or test the latest and greatest Bitcoin mining machines. And that sounds like a lot, 12,000 people, but it is less than half of the attendance of last year, which might have something to do with this, Bitcoin being 60% off its all-time high. We sent Marketplace's Matt Levin on an all-expenses-paid trip to Miami, again, fiat currency, to see what a Bitcoin convention looks like now that crypto winter seems to have returned. Here's what he brought back for us.
The best way I can describe this Bitcoin conference, well, it's about 60% normal business convention. Companies in a giant expo hall hawking their wares, small battalions of attractive young salespeople in brightly logoed t-shirts. And then the other 40% is, well, this type of stuff.
I'm asking everyone at the conference here if their butt's clean, because we're selling butt wipes.
Peter Barnetsky is manning a table in the convention's Bitcoin Bazaar, kind of a flea market for Bitcoin merch. Next to his Bitcoin-themed wipes is a toilet, like a real, actual toilet, with stickers of non-Bitcoin cryptocurrencies like Dogecoin adorning the inside of the bowl. Bitcoiners believe Bitcoin is the only digital currency that can and will replace traditional money. Although, judging by Barnetsky's sales, that might be a while.
We had about 20 sales so far since this morning. I would say maybe 3 or 4 used Bitcoin. The rest were either cash or credit.
Barnetsky says he doesn't own any Bitcoin, which was the case for a surprising number of people I talked to here. Tali Lindberg has a name for them.
Bitcoiners are people who maybe have heard of Bitcoin, but they are on the fence. They don't know what it is exactly. They don't trust it yet. They don't understand it.
Lindberg used to be a pre-coiner herself. She's a stay-at-home mom who homeschooled 4 kids in Kentucky. Her Bitcoin-loving husband developed a board game so she could better understand it, which is what they're now selling for $84.
It's called HODL Up. The goal for each player is to HODL as many Bitcoin tokens as possible.
HODL is a Bitcoiner credo, basically short for hold on for dear life, which is what Lindberg has done as Bitcoin's price fell from its $68,000 peak to about $27,000 today.
All I can say is every dollar that we have to spare, we put it into Bitcoin. You know, some people be like, you shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. I said, this is the only basket I believe in.
So-called Bitcoin maximalists actually cheered the downfall of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried. They hate the idea of centralized exchanges or really centralized anything. And they're used to riding the wild swings of the Bitcoin market.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Ben Briley is riding a mechanical bull in the center of the expo hall. He's on there for a minute and a half before he falls off. That ties his time from last year, which was almost enough to win.
Last year, first place was an entire Bitcoin.
That was worth around $40,000. This year's bear market prize, a VIP pass to next year's convention. Briley works for a global HR company. He says he takes home 10% of his salary in Bitcoin. And given the news about the traditional financial system lately, he's not selling.
Each one of these bank collapses, while the Federal Reserve sits there and tells you that the banking system is fine and there's nothing to worry about, is an advertisement for an egalitarian system like Bitcoin.
At times, Bitcoin 2023 could feel a little bit like Libertarian Comic-Con. There's a Plinko-style game where you try to navigate a coin away from banks and the Fed. One of the biggest applause lines from keynote speaker Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was against COVID lockdowns. And while the Bitcoiners I talked to were all pretty welcoming, I could see how tens of thousands of them invading your city all at the same time could be a little much. At a bar in South Beach, a group of Bitcoiners joins a karaoke chorus belting out Neil Diamond. Ileana Cordero can spot them pretty easily.
White socks and sneakers, some kind of dumb hat. I mean, they don't have a Miami vibe. They have a very, like, weird, like, look at this. They look like they're on a Carnival cruise line.
Cordero is a chef and a Miami local. She says her restaurant did business with the Bitcoin convention last year. She says while she never takes payment in Bitcoin, she does own some.
It's in one of those accounts I never look at, and it just kind of sits there, and it'll do what it does, and I don't need that money, so it's there to grow or to dissipate. We'll find out.
As will the rest of us. In Miami, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And we have blown that budget out of the water.
It happens, I guess. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 134 today, 0.4%, 32,908. The NASDAQ down 82 points, about 0.6%, 12,935. The S&P 500 fell 25 points, also 0.6%, 41.79. We heard from Lily Jamali about a report from the San Francisco Fed saying wage growth is not an important driver of inflation. So in some payroll stocks, how about that? Paychex docked 2.25%. ADP gave up about 0.5%. Paycom rose 0.1%. Brent crude, the oil that sets the global pricing standard. I know I say that all the time. We'll soon factor in oil from Texas. That is a change, by the way, that's been years in the making. So Texas oil stocks, Marathon Petroleum dropped almost 2.7%. ConocoPhillips down almost 1.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As much as everybody likes to complain about the federal government not getting things done, the fact of the matter is that laws are still getting passed and the bureaucracy is still grinding along. Case in point, back at the beginning of the year, President Biden signed into law the Martha Wright Reed Just and Reasonable Communications Act. It's named after a woman who worked for decades with others to lower the cost of prison phone calls. In Wright Reed's case, calls to her grandson. Now it's up to the Federal Communications Commission to decide exactly what just and reasonable means for the nearly 2 million families in this country with loved ones who are incarcerated. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on this one.
Pauletra James of Woodbridge, Virginia, spends almost a tenth of her income every month so she can get voicemails like this one.
Hello, this is a prepaid call from
JJ,
an inmate in the Virginia Department of Corrections, Carolina.
My son is incarcerated, and so it's very important for me as a mother to let him know that I'm here for him and that I support him. So communication is everything.
She regularly puts money into an online account so he can call her 3 or 4 times a week and send emails. James does the same for her husband, who's also incarcerated. She talks to him daily. Those costs add up to about $500 a month.
1 in 3 families with a loved one who's incarcerated goes into debt over the simple cost of a call and visits.
Bianca Tylek is executive director at advocacy group Worth Rises.
And 87% of those that are carrying this burden are women. And disproportionately, it's women of color.
Like Pauletra James of Woodbridge, Virginia, whose calls are so expensive partly because her loved ones are calling her from within Virginia. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, a 15-minute call like that can easily cost more than $4.
This is how I add money for me to be able to talk on the phone.
After years of pressure from advocates, back in 2014, Congress gave the Federal Communications Commission authority to cap the cost of prison calls. That brought the cost of calls down, but only for interstate calls. The industry successfully argued that the FCC could not cap rates on the roughly 80% of calls made within states. Now, says FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel,
what we're going to be able to do as a result of this new law is address intrastate rates with legal authority for the first time.
The new law also gives the FCC authority to regulate video calls. But to set the new rates, Rosenworcel says the FCC will have to balance competing interests, paying companies fairly while making it more affordable for families to stay in touch.
It plays a really big role in recidivism. As far as I'm concerned, justice requires that people who are incarcerated and their families can make sure that they stay in contact.
Which is why advocates are asking the FCC to cut the cost of these calls. Cheryl Lianza is a policy advisor for the United Church of Christ Media Justice Ministry.
We need to keep working to persuade the FCC to make these rates as low as possible and to persuade localities and states around the country to bring these costs down to as low as a free of charge.
Indeed, California, Connecticut, and some cities have made calls free for incarcerated people. But the industry that provides these services is also weighing in on the new rules.
Part of the challenge is that people don't understand the costs that go into providing this service.
Margita Thompson is Chief Communications and Community Engagement Officer for Aventiv, one of the two companies that control the majority of prison communications. Thompson says Aventiv wants the final rules to reflect the hundreds of millions of dollars the company has spent setting up and delivering phone and video calls in high-security environments.
How is it that we can balance these needs of the incarcerated individual while investing in the infrastructure that's needed to bridge the digital divide?
And who absorbs those costs is part of what the FCC has to decide. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This time last year, you looked at wheat, corn, soybeans, and oilseeds, your basic agricultural commodities, and prices were through the roof, due almost entirely to the Russian invasion of Ukraine having taken a whole lot of productive farmland out of the equation. Since then, though, supplies have stabilized, mostly, and prices are trending back down, mostly. According to the Commodity Price Index from the Department of Agriculture out today, the prices American farmers are getting are down 2.2% over last year. So the raw ingredients that go into the food we buy are getting cheaper, but the prices at the grocery store that we're paying are still high and climbing? Marketplace's Samantha Marr has that one.
To explain this, let's look at soybeans. Last June, prices surged to a record $17.69 a bushel. Since then, Eastern European farming is getting back on track, and Brazil saw a bumper soybean crop,
which is bringing prices down to the lowest level we've had in a few years.
Just about $13 a bushel, says Scott Gerlt with the American Soybean Association.
It's been a very, very significant swing.
For growers of soybeans and all the raw ingredients that go into our food, so our grocery bills should be shrinking too, right? Dean Rosenblum is an analyst with Bernstein.
It may be a slightly disappointing answer for listeners.
He says consumers usually only feel upward swings in commodity prices. The cycle goes like this.
When the supply side costs spike, prices on shelf in the grocery store also spike.
But retailers don't pass on the full cost of wholesale food inflation. So when commodity prices start coming back down,
the grocery pricing tends to stick, if you will.
Besides, says food economist David Ortega at Michigan State University, ingredient costs are just part of the pricing equation.
Out of every dollar that we spend on food, approximately 15 cents can be tied back to the farm.
He says everything that happens to crops after they leave the farm gates,
the processing, the packaging, the transportation,
is still much more expensive than it was a few years ago. So Ortega says falling commodity prices alone won't bring down stubbornly high food costs, but they might help slow the pace of inflation. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This is a big week for jobs data. I mentioned JOLTS earlier. We'll get the May unemployment report on Friday. So on that note, we're going to check in with April Oliver. She lives in Bozeman, Montana. We've been talking with her for more than 3 years now about how everything going on in this economy is affecting her. And as it happens, she has just had a job switch of her own.
I started a new job last year as a chemist. The pay is about the same, if not better, especially with benefits added in. And I feel pretty confident and secure in the long-term stability of my position. I just feel so much more relaxed. It's given me the opportunity also to take on a second job with more ease. So I'm teaching a biochemistry, organic chemistry survey class, which I taught in grad school, and I love teaching this class. We have student debt payments coming up in August, and so I wanted to have something that I could easily add on to my current workload with my full-time job in order to help my fiance pay for those. We also are getting married, and as you know, weddings are not very cheap. We decided on a budget, and we have blown that budget out of the water. There's a lot of things at play, and it just seemed to me to have money going into the bank to be the right decision. I'm falling into this pattern of thinking where I'm like, well, my dollar is so much more powerful right now. Like if I just spend everything or if I get those things done now, then maybe in the future when things are way more expensive, I'll be ahead. Even though I have this anxiety about a recession and I keep thinking like, well, maybe I should stop spending money. I see all these stories about the economy and it feels like a crazy time. But as a consumer, I feel almost unshakable. Like in the face of a $90 sheet of 3/4 ply, I'm still willing to buy that for some reason. It's making me crazy. I fall into one of those millennial hustle mindsets where any waking moment that I don't spend trying to make money is a wasted moment. I'm trying to unlearn that and enjoy my free time a little bit more, and I'm hoping to do that in this coming summer.
April Oliver, chemist, looking for some free time in Bozeman, Montana. This final note on the way out today, a couple of tidbits from the Fed's beige book that came out this afternoon. It's region-by-region anecdotal look at this economy. We talked about international travelers not coming back to the United States in big numbers on the program yesterday. Well, here's the counterpoint from the New York Fed. For the first time in 3 years, they write, graduation season has brought many international visitors to New York City. From the Atlanta Fed, an agriculture update. Demand for cotton remained weak, leading many farmers to plant less cotton than last year. Cattle demand, though, the Atlanta Fed says, was strong. And from the St. Louis Fed, economic activity linked to the Kentucky Derby rose more than 10% from the previous year. Estimates are the event surpassed pre-pandemic numbers. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. One more from the Beige Book, because why not? From the Dallas Fed, and a story, by the way, that Lily Jamali's been out in front of for us. Drilling and fracking activity for oil wells was essentially flat over the past 6 weeks, the Dallas Fed says, while natural gas-directed drilling actually declined. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Tirado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.